I'm expecting Advocate CS Levemede to join us in a few minutes.
Okay. I see Honorable Professor has joined us as well. Okay. I think when Honorable Nita joins us, we will just recognize her then. Should we wait for your official, or do you want us, or can you continue?
Yes, we can continue, Chair.
Welcome and good afternoon to honorable members, and welcome to the officials of the Department of Home Affairs and the Parliamentary Legal Advisor, Lutando Dikashi. Honorable members, at our last meeting that we held on the 18th of May 2020, members will recall that we received an overview of the salient points in relation to the written submission. At that meeting, it was also decided that the committee obtain a legal opinion on whether or not it is required to hold public hearings and vote. We did seek that opinion, and the committee members would have received that legal opinion, which was distributed to yourself. In essence, the opinion highlights the following, that given the fact that in the last meeting, most members indicated that they were satisfied with the pre-comments received on the civil union amendment vote, and that the committee had provided ample time for the public to make the pre-submissions. I want to maybe hand over to our legal advisor, who will take us through the legal opinion, and after that, I would also want to contextualize what the committee has done, and then open it up for discussion with members of the like to discuss it further. Nolitando, can I hand over to you, please?
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. Good afternoon, members and everyone else. My name, as the Chairperson has stated, is Nolitando Dikashi. I am the legal advisor for Parliament. We have provided an opinion to the Chairperson and the committee on the public participation after last committee meeting has been approved. I would not read the whole opinion. I would just go to the important legal conclusions that we have drawn looking at all the constitutional court judgments in respect of public participation. We have looked at three legal questions. One is, what does the Constitution say and require from Parliament in respect of public participation? Section 59, 72, and 118 of the Constitution place a constitutional duty on the National Assembly, the National Council of Provinces, and on provincial legislatures to facilitate public participation when exercising their legislative process. And the Constitutional Court case where a bill was challenged on the basis that there was lack of public participation, the court held that, I quote, "In our country, the right to political participation is given effect not only through the political rights guaranteed in Section 19 of the Bill of Rights as supported by the right to freedom of expression, but also by imposing a constitutional obligation on legislatures to facilitate public participation in the lawmaking process. The if effect of such public participation should be that, I quote again, all parties interested in the investigation should feel free to show that they have been given a real opportunity to have their say, that they are taken seriously as citizens, and that their views matter and will receive due consideration at the moment when they could possibly influence decision in a meaningful fashion. The objective of the public participation is both symbolical and practical. The persons concerned must be manifestly shown the respect to them as a concerned citizen, and the legislators must have benefit of all the inputs that will enable them to produce the best possible law. In other words, public participation afforded by Parliament must be meaningful, and it must be of such a nature that the court will find it meaningful and reasonable. We also looked at the second question which you were asked to consider. Does the Select Committee have a constitutional obligation to conduct public hearings, especially if the portfolio committee did not do so? Once the Constitution imposes an obligation on Parliament to facilitate public involvement in its legislative and other processes, including those of its committees, it does not tell Parliament how to facilitate public involvement. Rather, it leaves it to Parliament to determine how and what it will do to fulfill their obligation of public participation. The Constitution gives discretion to both houses of Parliament to determine how best to fulfill their constitutional obligation. This was affirmed by Judge Mbogo and even one in the case of Dr. Polite, which I have mentioned before. It stated that, I quote, "It is apparent that the Constitution contemplates that Parliament and the provincial legislatures would have considerable discretion to determine how best to perform their duty to facilitate public involvement. Said in relation to the specific duty to allow the public and the media to attend the meetings of the committee, the Constitution has deliberately refrained from prescribing to Parliament and the provincial legislatures the right method of public participation to be followed in any given case. In addition, it empowers Parliament and provincial legislatures to determine and control their own internal arrangements, proceedings, and procedures, and to make their own rules and orders concerning their business." I close quote. That's a little further stated that. It follows that Parliament and the provincial legislatures must be given a significant measure of discretion in determining how best to control their business to facilitate public involvement. Similar sentiments may be quoted in the Minister of Health, this is Lukis, which is a recent judgment in the public participation event. The court stated the forms of facilitating an appropriate degree of participation in the lawmaking process are indeed capable of infinite variation. What matters is that at the end of the day, a reasonable opportunity is offered to members of the public and all interested parties to know about the issues and to have an adequate say. The court jurisprudence reaffirms the existence of a duty of Parliament to involve public when developing and processing legislation, while also acknowledging that Parliament is discretionary how to go about allowing the public to participate in its business. Therefore, we are of the view that the committee has the power to decide how best to fulfill this obligation to facilitate public involvement. What is important is that there should be a reasonable opportunity offered to public to participate in the lawmaking process. The portfolio committee, in our view, correctly exercises this discretion that is allowed and it is affirmed by the court in different judgments. The last thing that we considered was whether virtual meetings should be hindrance in Parliament, giving meaningful public participation. It is common knowledge that our country is under lockdown in the national state of disaster was declared. This has compelled Parliament to find alternative ways of working to perform its function. As a result of such declaration, on 15 and 20 April 2020, the Speaker and the Chairperson respectively made back to enable Parliament to carry out its functions and fulfill its constitutional obligations. The NCOP rules relating to the town meetings provide that the subject to Section 72(1)(a) of the Constitution, a select committee must facilitate public involvement on matters before it by electronic means determined by the select committee. Taking all the above into account, virtual meetings are not a hindrance to the select committee calling for oral submissions, which it decides to do so, as is stated in the above paragraph, that the committee has discretion to decide how this meeting to hold public hearings or conduct public participation. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, unmute yourself.
You're muted.
No, my apologies.
No, Chair.
I had a lengthy conversation with myself, but let me thank you, Ms. Mutakashi. And also, I see Honorable Mutetwa and Honorable Nisha have joined us. Welcome. We just received a briefing from the Parliamentary Legal Advisory in terms of the advice. And I initially said that I would also want to take us through our process as well in relation to public participation. Our members, in light of the legal opinion, while we have an obligation to facilitate meaningful and reasonable public participation in terms of Section 72, Subsection 1A of the Constitution, it refers to the National Council of Provinces, the committee has discretion to decide on what would be the best way to facilitate public participation. We are not obliged to call for oral submissions, but rather to facilitate meaningful and reasonable public participation. The decision, members will also note that in one of the submissions, one of the organizations raised the issue of the fact that the portfolio committee on home affairs did not have public hearings. But the decision of that committee, the Peace Committee on Home Affairs, not to have public hearings, does not affect the discretion of the select committee. And the view that the bill could be rendered unconstitutional if no public hearings are held is also not correct. Honourable members, as I've indicated in our previous meeting, we have widely advertised the bill for written comments through print media, national and provincial papers, in all official languages from the 5th of November to the 6th of December. We have afforded reasonable time for members of the public to have their say, and we have received 325 submissions from both civil society organizations as well as 10 individuals. In addition, members, in the last meeting we received documentation, but we've also received a presentation from the content advisor who gave us an overview of the salient points as well as a summary document containing all the written inputs. Furthermore, in the previous meeting on the 18th of May 2020, most members also indicated that they were satisfied and understood the content of the submissions. Where we stand as a committee, having received all 325 submissions, we also have the benefit of all inputs from civil society organizations and individuals. I think in terms of procedure, as we received the presentation from the Parliamentary Legal Advisor, if we decide to move forward with this process, as well as from the department, we can then also continue as members of the committee to deliberate on the amendments and give due consideration of the inputs of the public. Members, I just try to contextualize our process in relation to the advice as well. But if members have any comments and issues that they would like to raise, please give me an indication. You may raise your hand, or I don't know if members know that there's a feature here where you can raise your hand. But you may also indicate in the chat group. While I understand some members might not have that feature, you may also indicate. are in agreement, then perhaps we can continue with our process. Madam Mendes? Okay, thank you, Honorable Bayola. Okay, members, then let me call on our legal advisor, Alessandro Sassi, once again to make a presentation in response to the written submissions that we received on the call. And thereafter, as a committee, we'll deliberate on the presentation. Alessandro, can I hand over to you?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I have, I'm not sure if members can see, I have shared my screen on the meeting.
I can see it, Alessandro. Honorable members, can you all see the presentation? If you can't see the presentation.
Yes, it's clear.
Thank you, Honorable members.
It's okay.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the Honourable Members. Chair, I will take the committee to the document that, the web document that Yolanda sent to the members yesterday. The presentation is just to highlight. The document goes to see that responses with regards to the issues that were raised. I will just, in the presentation, just highlight those important legal points that were mentioned. Here, as you all know, we are dealing with the Single Union Amendment. The bill seeks to repeal Section 6 of the Single Union Act, which currently allows civil servants who are employed in marriage offices to submit a request to the minister that they do not want to solemnize same-sex unions. I thought it is important that I give a background to the rise of the Civil Union Act. The Civil Union Act came as a result of the Constitutional Court judgment in the case of Minister of Home Affairs and the first followers in Ireland. In this case, the same-sex couple took their complaint to court and submitted that. The law excludes them from publicly celebrating their love and commitment to each other in marriage. The content of that decision comes from the common law definition, which states that marriage in South Africa is a union of one man and woman to the exclusion of others. In the second case, which is also considered in the same case, the Gay and Lesbian Equality Project challenged Section 30 of the Marriage Act, which provides that a marriage officer must put to each of the parties the following question. I quote, do you A, call all here present to witness that you take C as your lawful wife or husband. The reference to wife or husband is contended is unconstitutional to same-sex couple. The Constitutional Court considered the matter, and the Constitutional Court found that the failure of the common law and the Marriages Act to provide the means whereby same-sex couples can enjoy the same status, entitlements, and responsibilities accorded to same-sex couples constitute an unjustifiable violation of their right to equal protection of the law under Section 9(1) and not to be discriminated against under Section 9(2) of the Constitution. Such failure of the court house represents an unjustified violation of their right to dignity in terms of Section 10 of the Constitution. Parliament was then ordered to correct the difference. The court pointed certain binding considerations which Parliament should apply in passing the legislation to correct this defect. And those were, the court said, in exercising its legislative powers, Parliament would have to bear in mind that the objective of the new measure must be to promote human dignity, the achievement of equality, and the advancement of human rights and freedoms. The second guiding Parliament should be sensitive to the need to avoid a remedy that on the face of it would provide equal protection, but would do so in a manner that is in its context and application would be calculated to reproduce new forms of marginalization. Whatever accepting for one same-sex couple. And it should be the same as the benefits that are afforded to heterosexual couples. In the context of a deep past discrimination and continuing homophobia, appropriate sensitivity should be shown by providing a remedy that is truly and manifestly respectful of the dignity of the same-sex couple. Coming to the submissions that were made on the bill. The weather submissions which were made for the bill in the submission which were made against the bill. The ones that are against the bill also say that the repeal of Section 6 of the Civil Union Act violates Section 15(1) and 31 of the Constitution. They argue that the proposed amendment will not pass the Section 6 limitation test. This is our response. Indeed, as it is submitted, the right to have your freedom, religion, and belief is guaranteed in Section 15 of the Constitution. Section 15(1) provides that everyone has the right to freedom of conscience, religion, thought, belief, and opinion. This is based and also is a fundamental right which is entrenched in both our Constitution and in international human rights instruments that South Africa is given to. However, the distinction must be made between holding a belief and the public expression of that belief, because the practice of religion may lead to conflict with other rights in the Bill of Rights. He says that the Constitution, as correctly pointed out by Mario, who made the submissions and others, provides in Section 1 that the rights of the religious community to practice religion may not be exercised in a manner that is inconsistent with any provision in the Bill of Rights. This was also pointed by our Constitutional Court in the case of Christian education in South Africa, as is the Minister of Education, where the ban of corporal punishment in schools was challenged. The Constitutional Court remarked that members of the religious community may seek to use the freedom of religion as a shield to fend off attacks on constitutionally offensive from practices. As correctly pointed out and submitted by GAIO and other organizations who made the submission, Section 15 is, like any other right in the Constitution, not applicable. It is subject to Section 36 of the Constitution, which is normally referred to as the limitation clause. In terms of Section 36, the rights in the Bill of Rights may be infringed or limited only in terms of law of general application, to the extent that the limitation is reasonable and justifiable in an open and democratic society based on human rights, dignity, equality, and freedom. All relevant sections that are mentioned in Section 36 should be considered in looking at whether the limitation is justifiable and reasonable in an open and democratic society. Those cases would include the nature of the right that is violated, the importance and the purpose of the limitation, that is the purpose and the importance of infringing or violating the Section 15 right. The nature and extent of the limitation, the relationship between the limitation and its purpose, and whether there are any less restrictive means to achieve the purpose, all those factors must be taken into account. Limitation of Section 15 right plays a crucial role in resolving involving the right of an individual to freely exercise religion. This is because of the large scope of this right, which increases the likelihood of this intention. The terms that are used in Section 15 of the Constitution, such as religion, conscience, thought, belief, and opinion, cover a wide range of convictions. If one looks at Section 15, the importance of the purpose of the limitation, the nature and the extent of the limitation, the relationship between the limitation and its purpose. Section 6 may be justified intervention or a justifiable infringement to Section 51 of the Constitution. The Civil Union Act is a law of general application. It applies to everyone. And the limitation of the right to Section 51, one could argue that it is a reasonable and justifiable right in an open and democratic society based on human dignity, equality, and freedom, as required by Section 6 of our Constitution. The nature of the right is one that has been recognized by our court in the Great Judgment. That is the right of same-sex couples to enjoy rights that are guaranteed in the Constitution that are enjoyed by heterosexual couples. The court, however, even though I have tried to do everything right, considering the six factors that one needs to consider when limiting the right, the court has, however, shown an inclination to avoid the implication clause analysis of Section 15 where possible. Instead, the court has preferred to restrict the scope of the right. The effect of that is that not every practice claiming to be an exercise of the freedom of religion is if conscious and conscious to be discussed by our court. The court used to use to restrict the scope of the right to freedom of religion. The court would test the sincerity of the claimant's belief. The court would require that the claimant must show a substantial burden on the exercise of freedom of religion, or that the political practice is central to the tenet of one's religion. The court would also use contextual interpretation. The court will not protect practices that are specifically excluded from protection elsewhere in the Constitution. In this case, the right to be discriminated against that is guaranteed in Section 9 of the Constitution. For an example, when it comes to advocacy of patients, it will not matter that the applicant is motivated by religion. The expression of the belief will not be protected by the court. The principle that is developed in our jurisprudence is that the exercise of the freedom of religion must not be inconsistent with other rights that are guaranteed by the Bill of Rights, which is state has a duty to respect, protect, promote, and fulfill. It will apply the truth at least high enough. Another submission that was made by Christian Liu, they also submit that the proposed amendment violates Section 15 of the Constitution, but their submission goes further and proposed that the Constitution should be amended to remove sexual orientation in Section 9 as a ground for discrimination. My response is that this is a policy decision that the legislature could make, but I would love to point out that what the Constitutional Court says in the following judgment in regards to same-sex couples. I would quote Cameron J.A. pointed out that our equality jurisprudence has taken great strides in respect of sexual in the last decade. The cases articulate far-reaching sections of community equality, inclusive moral citizenship. They establish that gays and lesbians are a permanent minority in society who have suffered patterns of disadvantage and are consequently exclusively reliant on the Bill of Rights for their protection. The impact of discrimination on them has been severe, affecting their dignity, personhood, and identity at many levels, family as contemplated by the Constitution can be constituted in different ways, and legal conceptions of family and what constitutes family life should change as social practices and traditions change. Permanent same-sex partners are entitled to find their relationship in a manner that accords to their sexual orientation. And such relationships should not be subject to unfair discrimination. And same-sex life partners are as capable as heterosexual spouses of expressing and sharing love in a manifold form. This is what the Constitutional Court has said with respect to the rights of gay and lesbian people. Another submission was made by the Freedom of Religion South Africa. They submit that the repeal of Section 6 of the Civil Amendment Act would not pass constitutional muster because there are less restrictive means that exist for achieving the purpose and ensuring that same-sex couples wishing to conclude union are able to. They also submit that the bill should be rejected and be replaced with a new clause which they propose. My response is that they correctly submit that the right to one's opinion and conscience is really defined in the Constitution. available from this study of climate change. I've already stated that as I was saying, I've mentioned before that the person not consistent is not a constitution that are not protected anywhere else in the constitution. For instance, the court gave this example in the Queen's case where Rastafarian challenged his admission as a lawyer because he had a previous criminal conviction of possessing Dacha, and he claimed that position on the court gave an example that one cannot claim that having someone is a slave is a religious practice. The court would not protect such. Section 31 specifically provides that the exercise of the freedom that is guaranteed in Section 15 may not be inconsistent with any other provision in the Bill of Rights. For instance, if the state compels all children to attend school and as a parent, I that my decision will allow my child to go to school. The court will not protect such a religious right because that would be inconsistent with Section 29 of the Constitution. And this analogy that I just gave now is the same analogy that was looked at by the court in the Christian education case. It is important to note that the court, when it comes to corporal punishment, how does the whole symbolic, moral, and economic purpose of the ban on corporal punishment will be undermined if an exemption was carved out for the applicant? In this case, the applicant with the parents may say that corporal punishment is a way of disciplining their children that is allowed by the religion. Also, in the first case that I've just mentioned now, the court held that there is no automatic right to be exempted from the law not obtained on the ground of religion. Another submission was from the Court for Justice, which dealt with public participation. I will not go into this one because I have just given the opinion to the committee on what the Constitutional Court has said about public participation. However, I will also submit that the state may not unfairly discriminate on the civil service as provided from Section 9(1) of the Constitution who are marriage officers who choose to make use of Section 6 of the Civil Union Act. That is a correct submission. The state may not unfairly discriminate on anyone, including the civil servants that are marriage officers employed by the Department of Homeland Security. However, if you look at the right to equality and not to discriminate against, you have to look at that right, the right to religion, vis-a-vis the right to equality that the court found is, the court in the Foley case found that this right is being, the court found that the applicants are being denied this right to equality when they are allowed marriage. In order for such a limitation to be reasonable in an open and democratic society, the limitation must be constitutionally sound. To satisfy the limitations test, it must be shown that Section 6 of the Civil Union Act serves a constitutionally acceptable purpose and that there is sufficient proportionality between the harm done by the law and the benefit it is designed to achieve. The law of criminal application requires that the law that has now, and you allowed arguments that cannot be justified in an open and democratic society. The section is currently used to enforce the discrimination between heterosexual couples and sex couples. First of all, this is corrective plans to establish that sex is an obligation to reasonably accommodate the exercise of freedom of conscience, religion, and belief for marriage of the school because of their belief. And this reasonable accommodation is a principle, and in the former case where the tribunal extends from, the Constitutional Court in paragraph 159 remarks, I will read directly from the paragraph. Reading in of the ways or styles has the advantage of being simple and direct. It involves minimal sexual alteration. The values of the Constitution will be upheld. The existing institutional mechanisms for the celebration of marriage would remain the same. Budgetary implications would be minimal. The long-standing policy of the law to protect and enhance family life would be sustained and extended. Negative stereotypes would be undermined. Religious institutions would remain undisturbed in their ability to perform marriage ceremonies according to their own tenets. And thus, if they wish to celebrate the tourist family. The principle of reasonable accommodation could be applied by the state to ensure that civil marriage officers who had sincere religious objections to officiating the same-sex marriages could not themselves be obliged to do so if this resulted in the violation of their conscience. If Parliament wished to define or replace the remedy with another legal requirement that met constitutional standards, it could still have the last word. If you read this paragraph, one would know that Parliament would consider reasonable accommodation, which they tried to do by introducing Section 6 of the Civil Union. The court respected and recognized that Parliament would still have the last word in making legislation. And as I stated before, when I started the presentation, there is certain precedent that the court cautioned and told Parliament to consider when crafting legislation that would recognize same-sex marriage. The principle of reasonable accommodation is a very important one in our constitutional democracy. As was described in the PA case, it's an exercise in proportionality that will depend ultimately and intimately on the text of the text. So that means one would have to look at the text of each text. The principle was earlier developed by the court in the Christian Education Court and the two cases, which I've alluded to before. In all these cases, the issue was whether a particular party has been exempted from complying with generally applicable rules in order to accommodate that party's the first consideration in the principle of reasonable accommodation concerns the nature and the importance of the right being limited, which includes the nature and history of the group whose right has been affected. The second consideration is whether the legislation that limits these rights serves a legitimate government purpose and whether it achieves that purpose. The final part asks whether less restrictive means exist to attain the same government purpose. In this case, I would submit that Section 6 of the Civil Union Act accommodates religious freedom of those civil servants who are married or object to conduct same-sex marriages. On the other hand, that accommodation violates the constitutional rights of same-sex couples who wish to marry in terms of the legislation. The way currently Section 6 fails to meet basic constitutional standards. And the entire of reasonable accommodation, one should consider whether the belief for which accommodation is sought after is genuinely held and whether the belief then can be practiced without contravening the law. At this point, I wish to point out that the way Section 6 is currently drafted is done in an arbitrary way because the same marriage officers who are civil servants have no rights under the marriages. To marry anyone under the Civil Union Act, and the only ground to refuse is that of sexual orientation. And it is also important to mention that Section 6 does not take away the right of civil servants that is guaranteed in Section 51 of the Constitution. It simply limits it and says that when you are practicing your freedom of religion, conscience, and opinion, you should not violate any of the rights that have protection under the Bill of Rights, which in this case I've already mentioned, is Section 9 of the Constitution. When considering policy or reasons that that one could advance for the purpose of protection that it is religious rights, there should be no exemption from a law that protects fundamental rights of individuals. This was stated by Judge Sass in the Prince case, where he said that Section 31(2) of the Constitution denies protection to religious practices such as human sacrifice because they infringe fundamental rights of others. You can use the same analogy in this case. I would submit that the aim of the Civil Union Act is to protect the rights of the same-sex couples and to correct the discrimination which is found to be unfair and unconstitutional by the court in the Holy Case. The exemption granted to civil servants in Section 6 of the Civil Union has the opposite effect of discriminating against them and revoking their right to dignity. There were other submissions which supported the repeal of Section 6 of the Civil Union Act. Most of them state that Section 6 of the Civil Union Act is a violation of Section 9(3) and 10 of the Constitution. Some raise an important point that the civil servant who are married or the civil servant obligation if they are in the employ of the state to ensure realization of the rights that are enshrined in the Constitution. Some point out that doctors and nurses have no right to choose whether to provide a service to terminate a pregnancy or not, despite the religious belief and conscience. It seems it is only the civil servants who are working as marriage officers have this right in either compared to other professions, either jobs. Section 197 of the Constitution places an obligation on the public service to function in terms of the national legislation and to loyally execute the lawful policies of the government and of the state, which Civil Union Act is. There are the two key principles that everyone who is employed in the public service should abide to, and those include the respect for one's dignity, the respect for equality, and all the other things that are listed in the matrix in the principles. Section 173 of the Constitution further provides that no employee of the public service may be favored or prejudiced only because that person supports a particular political party or cause. Another submission was made by Free Gender, the Liberal Justice Center. They submitted that they are concerned about the 24-month period to get to the close door of the law. They submit that allowing marriage officers another 24 months to continue to make same-sex couples is a continuous violation of the right to equality and dignity of the same-sex couple. In this instance, I would request to represent that the department responds on that one. This is a policy issue and it's very administrative in nature. That is the end of my presentation.
Thank you, Ms. Ndikashi. Thank you for that presentation. I think we have recently covered all the comments that stakeholders have made. I think in terms of that, the issue of the 24 months, perhaps the department, from the side of the department, can you perhaps also make your presentation now before members then engage with? Is it Advocate Tieti or Mr. Tupi Mutiani that will make this presentation?
Hello.
You're not very clear.
I'm
I'll try again. It's here. This is a limited.
Thank you.
Donatando, could you remove the presentation?
Okay, I'll remove it. It's gone now. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you,
sir. I'm going to share in a family presentation, but I'll certainly say the presentation is made by Monitando. We have engaged with this, I think, from the portfolio from the state, and we have not disagreed with the content thereof.
You on mute, Chairperson?
Sorry about that. I moved my mic so I interfere with the sound. But from your side, I can't hear you clearly.
We can't hear you clearly. Let me try to use the earphones. Maybe it'll be better. Hello, Chair. Is it better now? Yes, I was saying the presentation has been made by Norutando. We have engaged with it and we don't have any issues with it. Because some of the things were mentioned at the portfolio committee stage. So, with regard to the issue of the transitional period of 24 months, there were submissions that were made in the portfolio committee. So, and with the deliberations on the issue of saying we need to prepare officials to retrain them, to make them to adjust to the new way of doing things. So some of them were employed at the point where the law was allowing objections. Therefore, we need to take them through, and the department must go around, throughout the country, offer training just to enlighten officials with regards to, you know, the Civil Union Act and the provisions, also to create that issue of balance of the rights, explaining to them. So we have then, with those deliberations occurred there, then I agree that perhaps a period of 24 months will be sufficient to allow the department to reorganize itself whilst the changes are being made in the Act. Because some of the offices, for example, would not have any official at this point who has not objected to the solemnization of a civilian of people of the same sex. So it was more around that those deliberations. So, and then the decision was then at that point or thought to be put in that we allow a period of a transitional period of about 24 months. So I think that's basically what led to the discussions at that point and also the decision that was made there. So we had then made, I was part of some of the meetings where we had gone to train officials. And from that point, we've seen a bit of an increase of the officials who had then opted to say they will
well prepared. But going forward, any official who is to be employed part of the services or the job functions will be to solemnize marriages. They would, the job advert will specifically indicate the types of the marriages, and there's no way that, obviously, as we onboard them with the inductions and the like, so we'll also be making sure that we prepare officials and enlighten them or educate them much better in terms of the balance of the rights, as part of some of them were explained by Nodotando. I think, Chair, summarily, I'll say that, and I've got my colleague, Sam Tian, who's the Director of Policy, who may also come in, should he have anything to add, Chair, through you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Advocate, and thank you, Nodotando, for the presentation. I think it does clarify quite a few issues. Honourable members, like I've got Honourable Nita, who is
the presentation by the department, and some of my concerns, I think, were answered during the presentation. My main concern, ma'am, was that of the officials who's going to officiate this kind of marriage, because really it was like a blind spot to me. But after this presentation, there's light on the tunnel, because we don't argue now about the marriage, we only argue about the process through the marriage. To me, I'm covered. Thank you so much, madam.
Thank you. Honorable
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson, for the opportunity. Firstly, let me welcome the presentation. I think it was quite important, especially when are called upon to observe the constitution by ensuring that the people are at the center of what in parliament. And I think
see him.
In my see him.
And what the devil would like to see you.
Yes, I think the people Honorable Chairperson.
Okay, let's find you very audible. Please continue.
Am I audible? Let me go very quickly.
No, you're audible.
All that I was saying, Honorable Chair, that public participation is very much important. It's actually one of the cornerstones of our constitutional dispensation must be addressed. And going forward as Parliament, not only about this bill, but about all the bills and the laws that we are making as lawmakers, we must make the point that we bring people in the mainstream of the Parliament. Because our view is that public participation is part of our philosophy of people-driven, people-centered approach to development. And as a country, and as this Parliament especially, we can only succeed if we bring people closer. And going forward, I propose that we need to sit down, develop very, very clear, simple, straightforward mechanisms to encourage, to ensure public participation in the lawmaking processes. For me, that is very much important. The second point is about this. I think this bill is quite clear as it was presented. It is something that we must uphold, and I think its underpinnings are about to protect especially women who are vulnerable, who in the past were not protected. And so many things have happened in the past where women were just exploited, and many things around their marriage were happening without their involvement, without their awareness, without their consent. And all of this, because they are now encapsulated in our legislation, this is something that we must really encourage. And out of this process, once we have enacted the bill, I think the challenge would be, as Parliament, what do we do to ensure that we popularize the bill, with the law itself, know it, and therefore people adhere.
Thank you, Honorable Bidobin. Is there any other honorable member who would like to make a contribution or ask a question? Honorable Fletu, would you want to make a contribution?
I'm fine, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Honorable Zandamela, if you're with us, would you like to make a contribution? Honorable Zandamela? Honorable Fisher?
Thank you, Chair. I am satisfied. Thank you.
Thank you.
No, I'm okay, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Honourable Members. I think maybe just from my side before I hand over to the team. I agree that, you know, as the legislature, we are the Parliament is the legislative authority, and there is a clear separation of powers. But just in terms of Section 6 itself, just to be clear, that it refers to public servants only as marriage officers, and I think maybe we must just get that clarified. And I think the Constitution is like quite clear, you know, with reference to the principles that underlie the public service, and that the state may not discriminate, and public servants are expected to provide services in a non-discriminatory and a fair manner to ensure the realization of rights. And clearly this bill does deal with competing rights. But I just wanted to other issue was partly covered in terms of the 3-4 month issue. But I would also want to know, let me leave that because I think the department did come in and explain the 24 month matter. I think maybe let me then hand over to yourself. Can you start with the department? Because I think we're focusing a lot on the transitional provision. And then, Melisandre, you can close. Advocate? You can mute your mic, please. Advocate, are you still with us? Melisandre, let me start with you. I don't know where the advocate is, but you should be with us. Melisandre?
Yes, I'm there.
Can you maybe give some responses? I know a lot of comments, but if you could give some responses, please.
Yes. Thank you, Chair. Yes, Chair. Section 6 of the Officer Union only refers to the marriage officials who are employed by the department. The court has made it clear in the following judgment that the other marriage officers who are marriage officers because they are priests or imams or whatever in their religion don't have to solemnize same-sex marriage. So this only focuses on the ones who are employed by the state's marriage officers. And second, you say you asked about the termination of pregnancy. In my research, I think it seems that there's no other public servant who has been given a choice to apply for an exemption. The article that I read is written right after the Civil Union Act was passed. It is even making an example about how the test was passed, because also at the time there was a lot of outcry from the community about same-sex marriage. And the writer of the article, who is a professor at BED, even mentions that it is parliamentary members who don't have a choice whether to pass this bill or not. They were told that you must pass this bill. So they were not given the right to exercise their freedom in terms of Section 15 of the Constitution. So yes, no other public service has been given this kind of exemption. Hence, I think there's an outcry now that
I'm sorry for coming in so late. My question is just about the transitional requirements. The aim of the bill is actually to get rid of what is considered a discriminatory practice. What is then the need for the transitional period? Would it not then, because it leans on a specific discrimination, would it then not be more advisable to rather make the bill immediately effective? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Mikulakis. Advocate CSC, are you with us? Advocate? Zolani, could you please find out where the advocate is?
I've just alerted the official from the department to speak with him.
Okay, but do we have Mikiani with us? I don't know if he can respond.
I haven't gone.
No, Chair, he's back. He's back online. He's just muted. Advocate, if you can unmute. Yeah, we can hear you.
No, it's I don't know, technology here is disappointing. Yes, Chair, Nolu Tando covered it, but what I wanted to add is that the act already, the procedure for designation of marriage officers, for example, of coming from religious organizations, already is crafted in a way that says the registration is not about an individual priest, but an organization itself that registers. So that we were trying to avoid where you find a religious organization, as Nolu Tando indicated, that there was a lot of objections. So we didn't want to find a priest within a religious organization coming to apply but not supported by the religious organization. So it's done in that way. So Section 6 was only now only deals with public servants. And furthermore, there's no precedent as indicated as well. This was the only one, and it was on the face of the objections at that time. But the issue of transitional arrangement, I think, as I explained, says try to give us time to, you know, when people had objected, you also need to try and bring them on board properly, so because some of them are, they've got the function. So we will not necessarily say to them, because you are not, we don't want to further perpetuate the discrimination, but we need to bring them on board properly and educate them or enlighten them. And I think, like I indicated, we have already started this, but we have not done through the country altogether. So we're seeing a bit of improvement after a bit of engagement with the officials. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Advocate. Members, do you have any follow-up? Or can I wrap up? I don't have any notification from any member. Members, and maybe maybe just indicate that we are in this matter, we are dealing with competing rights, and members have been privy to all the documents and all the submissions that we received from civil society organizations. I think we should at this point thank these organizations and individuals who made written submissions from the call to the committee. And I think in terms of the presentations we received, it was quite enlightening from our parliamentary legal advisor. And indeed, their inputs have been invaluable. And to a large extent, also especially in terms of processing this call. I would also want to thank the parliamentary legal advisor for her advice and input, as well as the Department of Home Affairs for their input. Members, if you could then perhaps just allow my office to then put a report together on this matter, and we will then process the goal further in terms of deliberation and or adoption in a future meeting, which we will check. With that said, honourable members, thank you very much for your participation and for your attendance. I want to also just note the two apologies which we didn't deal with when we started the meeting. The apology from Honourable Mola and Honourable Leyea.